cuts will be devastating for the WILL stations. Some in Congress believe public broadcasting is one of the worthiest places to invest federal funds. We hope you will call your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. But please act soon. The full House of Representatives could take final action on these cuts by Wednesday, June 22nd. For the phone numbers of your members of Congress, visit our website at will.uiuc.edu or call 217-333-1070. It's very important that Washington hear from you on whether federal funding for WILL should be cut or restored. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back on the program here one of our regulars, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here, and we talk about money management. And he begins by making some comments. Sometimes he wants to talk a little bit about the economy. Sometimes it may be a particular kind of investment or financial planning topic. So we'll give him a chance to do that. And then, if people have questions, we'll take them. And it can be about whatever it is he's about to talk about, or it can be anything else that has to do with financial planning and money management. I know that Dave will do his best to help you out. So with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, for most of us, it's been a very tough investment year. Most stocks and stock mutual funds are negative for the year, or perhaps break even at best. And short-term interest rates are basically in the 2%, maybe 2.5% range, depending. What in the world should we be doing with our investment funds? I'm getting asked that question literally 2, 3, 4 times a day. Walk down the hallways of Wohlers Hall this morning. Someone asked me that question at the University of Illinois. Should I be in bonds, stocks, or real estate? Or maybe, as the Wall Street Journal is suggesting today, maybe I should be investing in France or Italy, where real estate is increasing 50 to 75% over the last 2 to 3 years. Or how about Bulgaria? Isn't that interesting, where prices have, well, doubled in the last 24 months? Not sure I'm ready for that. First, I want to share with you what I truly believe to be some of the most important pillars of a successful investor. I call them the three pillars of investing. And after I share these three pillars with you, I'm going to construct for you my cookbook or model stock and bond portfolio, sort of back to the basics. Pillar number one, it's not how much money you make in the good times that determines your success as an investor. Rather, it's how little money you lose in the bad times. The number one job of you as an investor is to lose as little capital as possible in those inevitable periods of time where both stocks and bonds head south in the wrong direction. Let me give you a quick example. David, you hire me to manage a $10,000 portfolio. I report back to you at the end of the year that your return on your portfolio after I've done all of this extraordinary manipulation is exactly 0%. Now, naturally, you're a little bit disappointed, especially since you personally invested $10,000 in two very impressive stocks that increased 50% in value during the year. Well, you're very nice to me, David, and you give me a second chance. And at the end of the second year, I report back to you once again that you've earned 0% on your portfolio and you still at least have your $10,000. On the other hand, your two stocks that performed so beautifully a year ago that went up 50% in value, well, they did a little bit of a reversal and they actually dropped 50% in value. On the portfolio I managed for you, the average return was 0%. On your stock portfolio, your average return was also 0%, plus 50 and minus 50. But which portfolio has more money at the end of the 2 years? Obviously, the portfolio I managed for you still has, well, unfortunately, just $10,000. But your portfolio, which started at $10,000, went up 50%. So it went up to $15,000, and then it dropped 50%, and my goodness, you now have $7,500. Your portfolio, in other words, has not only less money, but was far more volatile. the moral of the story here and pillar number one, volatility destroys portfolios because you lose huge amounts of money in those down years. And a well-constructed portfolio can mitigate volatility through something called effective diversification. And I'm going to talk about that a bit more later on. Let's move on to pillar number two. Forget about this business about trying to time the stock markets or the bond markets. The so-called experts can't even figure out where one, interest rates or stocks are heading, either in the short run or the long run. Rather, commit yourself to becoming a legacy investor. That is, commit yourself to the accumulation of shares on a regular basis rather than worrying about the price on any given day. Over the long run, you will average out. And if you're not willing to own stocks for a minimum of 15 to 20 years, you have no business purchasing them in the first place. Remember, you are in the share accumulation business, not the price or timing business. If you regularly invest, things will even out for you and you will continue to accumulate, accumulate, and accumulate more shares. He or she who has the most shares at the end of the day is the winner, not he or she who decided when to buy and when to sell. So the truth of the matter is that all of those fancy television programs that tell you what the stock market's going to do tomorrow and what stock is hot today, I consider that not only background noise, but a disservice to investors because all it talks about is the direction of the market in the short run and when to get in and when to get out. That's not the business of a long-term profitable investor. Pillar number three, expenses really do matter, especially over the long term. That's why I generally recommend investing in low-cost index mutual funds. Let me give you an example. Let's assume that you have two children, perhaps two grandchildren, and they each invest $3,000 per year in Roth IRAs for 35 consecutive years when they graduate from college. Now, that's a laudable goal. You get out of college, you take some money each month, you put in maybe $250 into your Roth IRA program, and you do this during your working career, perhaps as much as 35 years. Grandchild number one nets 7% after fees from actively managed mutual funds or brokerage fees. That's the net because the actual grandchild paid 1.5% in all of these additional fees. So the net after paying these fees, let's just assume 7%. But grandchild number two has the same basic investments as grandchild number one, but nets 8% because the fees are only 0.5% per year as opposed to 1.5%. And that might be, for example, on index funds. Well, here's the bottom line. At the end of 35 years, grandchild number one, who paid 1.5% in management fees, has about $415,000 in their portfolio. But grandchild number two, who really paid attention to expenses and cut those expenses just by 1% over that period of time, that grandchild has $516,000 in their portfolio, more than $100,000 of difference, or on a percentage basis, just about 25%. Can you imagine what a 1% fee difference means over long, long periods of time? Pillar number three, expenses really do matter. They compound in the wrong direction over many, many years. All right. Now I'm going to share with you what I believe to be a reasonably conservative portfolio, which is basically comprised of Vanguard index funds. I call it my cookbook portfolio. I basically present it to my finance classes each semester. I talk to them about it. It's not quite the couch potato portfolio. The couch potato portfolio really involves just putting 60% of your money in the S&P 500 and 40% of your money in a standard bond index, and then you just sit on the couch, I guess, eat potato chips, and watch television and veg out. Probably you'd be better off listening to David Inge, at least in the mornings, Monday through Friday, and then eat those potato chips a little bit later on. So this is a bit more sophisticated than the couch potato portfolio. Now, first of all, it's conservative. Why? Because it's a 50-50 portfolio. 50% of your money is going to be in fixed income, and 50% of your money is going to be in the stock market. So with every dollar, 25 cents of that dollar, we're going to buy the Vanguard short-term bond index. It's a very short-term bond index. Typically has an average maturity and duration of about 2 years. We're going to take another 25 cents of our money, and we're going to buy the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index. That's an index mostly of U.S. bonds and securities, about 5% foreign bonds and securities. It has an average maturity and duration of somewhere between 4 and 5 years. That's it. I'm buying those two indexes, or either averaging into those two indexes, with 50 cents of my dollar. All right? So I've spent 50 cents. It's in fixed income, and I don't worry about it. I don't worry about it because over long periods of time, I know how those funds are managed, and I'm going to get average interest rate and total returns. Next, I'm going to take 5 cents of my dollar, and I'm going to buy the S&P 500 at Vanguard. 5 cents. That's it, because I only have 50 cents left to spend. I'm going to take another 5%, and I'm going to buy something called the Mid-Cap Index. Sometimes it's referred to as the S&P 400. The largest 100 stocks in the S&P 500 sometimes are called the S&P 100. And then the remaining 400 are called the S&P 400 or the mid-caps. So I'm going to take 5 cents and buy that asset class. The next asset class I'm going to buy with another nickel of my money are the small caps. Typically, people hear about the Russell 2000. Those are 2,000 of the smaller companies traded on the exchanges. Well, you know I'm a believer in value investing. So I'm going to take 10 cents and I'm going to buy the Vanguard Large Value Index, and I'm going to take 10 cents, and I'm going to buy the Vanguard Small Cap Value Index, and now I only have 15 cents left to spend. Well, although it tugs at my heart, I've got to spend at least 5 cents in real estate. Now, some people would want to spend more, especially the way everybody has been talking about real estate over the last 24 to 36 months. But I'm going to spend 5 cents, invest 5 cents of my money in the Vanguard Real Estate Investment Trust or the REIT Index. So I'm going to own apartment buildings. I'm going to own shopping centers. I'm going to own warehouses, all kinds of stuff. But I'm going to own it in a liquid form of shares. I'm going to own it in the sense that I own little tiny pieces of corporations, just like a Microsoft, just like an Intel, just like a IBM. 5 cents of my dollar is going to be in the REITs. And my final 10 cents I'm going to put out in the international sector. 5 cents of that 10 cents is going to be in something called emerging markets. Emerging markets. Now, the emerging markets are Korea, Taiwan, China, South Africa, Brazil, India. Those are some of the emerging markets. I'm going to put 5 cents into that portfolio. And then I'm going to go to Vanguard and use something called the Total International Index. That's where my last nickel is going in my portfolio. The Total International Index really is a stock index which includes Europe, Australia, the Far East, the Pacific Rim, as well as the emerging markets itself. Well, how's the portfolio done at least this year? And interestingly enough, it's done pretty decently considering most other indexes are underwater. Through yesterday, the index, or this called this cookbook portfolio, it was up a little bit over 2% on a total return basis, not including dividends. Not bad, not bad. So it's probably in the 2.5% range with less than half the year going. And we could compare that to the small cap index, the large cap indexes, which are typically down about 2% for the year. So I'm running about 4 to 4.5% ahead of some of my proxies. More importantly, how has this portfolio done over the last 10 years? Well, it's averaged about 8% on a total return basis. In other words, this portfolio has doubled approximately every 9 years. But more importantly, while it has averaged 8%, in those horrible, awful years of 2000, 2001, and 2002, when people were just screaming as they were watching their high-tech stocks hemorrhage from $100 to a dollar, this portfolio pretty much held its own. And indeed, it actually went up. It actually went up because of its diversification. Because by having all of these different asset classes in this mix, it basically had low volatility. So here's what I really want you to remember. If you are working with an advisor or you're working with a broker, ask your broker or advisor to calculate the volatility of your portfolio, which is really broken down into two acid questions. Question number one, what average return should I expect on my portfolio? I think that's a fair question to ask your broker when your broker is buying and selling these positions for you. What should I expect? And question number two, could you please calculate to one standard deviation for me, which means at least two-thirds of the time, what range of return should I expect in any given year as compared to my average? So, if you told me that on average I should expect a rate of return of 8%, then tell me at least two-thirds of the time what is my range around the average. Should I expect somewhere a return of 12% on the high side and 4% on the low side? Or should I expect 20% on the high side and minus 5% on the low side? And what I want you to remember is that the greater the range from the average, the more volatile a portfolio you have, and the more likely your portfolio can seriously hemorrhage in bad stock and bond years. So you want your advisor, you want your broker to calculate for you, using some basic mathematics or some basic statistics, what is that range of returns around my average that I should expect? Once you do that, you can understand the volatility of your portfolio, and your investment job is to understand the degree of volatility of your portfolio and determine whether it is appropriate for you. So those are some back to basics, some basic pillars of investing, things that people seem to forget sometimes when we see runaway asset classes such as real estate, where everybody is just dying to get in to the real estate market.
All right. Well, our guest this morning here on Focus 580, Dave Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance at the U of I. He's here once a month, always on a Friday. We talk about investing in money management. If you have questions on this issue that Dave has been talking about, how to construct a portfolio of investments or anything else that has to do with money management, you give us a call. I know he will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something else I thought I'd just ask you about real quick, because I had recently saw an article about it, has to do with mortgages, home mortgages. And the concern that the article raised was that there are apparently a lot of people who are taking advantage of adjustable rate mortgages, because the initial rate is very attractive and it keeps your payments down. And they say to you, sometime in the future, your payment could go up. We're not exactly sure what that's going to be. But apparently there are a lot of people that are betting that rates really aren't going to go up. And the possibility is that you could have a really an attractive payment today, but sometime 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the road, you could suddenly find your payment doubling or at least substantially going up. And the sort of the thrust of this article was, you know, don't make that bet that interest rates are going to stay low, because chances are they're probably not.
No question about it, David. What you're talking about typically is a 3-1 ARM adjustable rate mortgage. Now, if you opt for a standard conventional 15 to 30 year mortgage, you're going to be paying a rate of about 5.5 to 5.6, maybe 5.75%. An adjustable rate mortgage is about 100 basis points or 1% below that currently. So you could lock in to begin with about 4.6. And on a 3-1 arm, that's locked in for 3 years. The problem is at the end of 3 years, if interest rates have moved up, and I'm not saying they will or they won't, but your mortgage can move up a maximum of 2% in any given year and typically 6% over the life of the mortgage. So it is entirely possible once that ARM, once that 3-year period expires, you could be looking at 6.6, 8.6, and indeed even 10.6. So you're right that that rate could more than double over the life of an adjustable rate mortgage. Interestingly enough, there is another mortgage product which has become just the apple of a whole lot of people's eye, especially in California, and that is an interest-only mortgage. Get this, where the average price of a home in these metropolitan areas is anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million, people actually can go in and procure an interest-only mortgage on 90%, up to a 90% loan. So if you're going to buy a $1 million home, find, beg, borrow, and steal $100,000, and then you can procure a $900,000 mortgage, interest only, for as much as 3 to 5 years. Can you imagine that? At current interest rates, and then the hammer comes down if you've still got the property, because then the amortization period actually is compressed by that 3 to 5 years that you've been doing the interest. And of course, the interest rate changes dramatically. So your payment overnight could double or even more. Now, the bet in California is, hey, I'll take my interest rate bet here over the next 3 to 5 years because I'm going to be selling this house over the next 3 to 5 years because of the appreciation that I'm going to get on the house, because appreciation in these metropolitan areas, California, have been 20, 25, 30% a year. So people are betting I'll pay some tax-deductible interest. Okay, it will stretch me. I probably won't have any furniture in my home. But 3 to 5 years from now, I'm going to be in a situation where maybe I'm making $250,000 to $500,000 of gain on my home. And oh, by the way, the U.S. government, that is the Internal Revenue Service, tells me that if I'm a married taxpayer and I live 2 consecutive years in my home as my personal residence and then I sell it, the first $500,000 of gain, can you imagine, if it even exists, and I get it, it's not subject to tax. So there is a lot of incentive for people to go out and bet the ranch. Stay tuned. That could be, you know, a good investment. Then again, things could, as I say, regress to the mean, and it could turn out to be a debacle.
All so, right. Well, we have a couple callers here. We'll start out with someone here in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi, this is very closely related to what you were just talking about. The question I wanted to ask you was, do you believe that there's a bubble in the housing market?
Well, that's a very, very tough question. I just asked that question to all of my students in my finance class, and several of them wrote papers about it, and some of those papers were excellent. But you can't spend a day looking at the Wall Street Journal where we don't see an article about housing bubbles. I think what we're going to see is clearly a slowdown in the appreciation of housing. And Alan Greenspan talks about it in the terms of there's a froth in the real estate market. My view is that we're not going to see dramatic downturns in the short run in the price of real estate, but we're not going to see these dramatic appreciation levels. Those are just going to stop. Now, what I have seen is where you are in a metropolitan area where you have continued job growth, positive job growth, that translates dramatically into substantial appreciation in housing. So if I'm looking in a metropolitan area, the first thing I would do is check with the local chamber of commerce and get all of the statistics in that area on job growth and prospects for job growth, because job growth drives housing prices. Interest rates clearly drive housing prices. But as if most people inevitably believe that interest rate prices are going to go up, that means mortgages are going to get more expensive, what's going to continue to drive these housing prices in these areas? And that's job growth. It's not population growth, it's job growth, because good jobs translate into the ability to procure mortgages and continue to buy housing. So bottom line for me is if I was looking in any of these metropolitan areas, whether it's the Washington, D.C. area, whether it's the L.A. area, whether it's, for example, Seattle, any of these areas, I'd be most concerned about the prospects for continued job growth. And if I saw continued job growth and expansion, I wouldn't be worried about housing prices.
Okay, thanks.
All right, very good. Let's go on to line number four. This is Bloomington, Illinois. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. Two comments. First of all, I'd like to thank David Sinnoh for the comments that he's made over the years. I first heard him on WILL about 10 years ago, and since that time I have been able to put together a portfolio to make my own future substantially more secure. So I just want to say I appreciate his being on the show and appreciate WILL for that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. The second comment that I have is in regard to an article in this month's Atlantic by James Fallows. In the article, he presents a scenario where by the year 2016, there will have been a precipitous decline in the value of the dollar, which will result in, and again, this is an imaginary scenario, but he presents it as being more probable than not. Decline of the value of the dollar would increase interest rates, cause widespread unemployment, and a whole host of other scenarios that would generally lead to social disorder. And essentially, the thrust of the article is that whatever you do in terms of investment, the economy is going to be in such bad shape. If we continue with deficit spending, that there's no way out. And I'd just like to get your perspective on that kind of scenario. A lot of people talked about the decline of the dollar, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, that's a great question. And I've asked that question of several economists at the University of Illinois. I remember one I spoke to about 6 months ago, Professor Fred Gottheil, who certainly is one of the icons in economics. And I asked him, I said, Fred, I said, what happens with a major decline of the dollar or a precipitous decline of the dollar? And he said, you know, a lot of people are forecasting doom and gloom. But on the other hand, it makes our goods much less expensive. And as a result of making our goods much less expensive, we're going to sell a whole lot more goods around the world and everywhere that you can think of. So unless it is a dramatic, major, substantial drop in the value of the dollar, that a cheap dollar actually spells more jobs, more manufacturing, and more output for the U.S. economy. So while Fred wasn't willing to say that we were going to have this dramatic drop in the dollar, I think he made some good points, and that is that a less expensive dollar allows really for growth and expansion in the economy, contrary to the way a lot of people think. Now, deficit spending, I guess that's a whole nother business because foreign governments up to now have really been willing to buy our treasuries and really fund, if you will, our deficit spending. And it's big time. It's about $1.8 billion a day. And looking at the national debt clock a couple of days ago, I saw that our national debt was over $7.8 trillion. You divide that by 290 million people in America, that's about $26,000 per person. So I guess we could all write a check back to the federal government for $26,000 and erase our debt, but that's not going to happen. So we've got deficit spending to the tune of $1.8 billion a day, almost $500 billion a year. And who is funding that? Foreign governments are funding that. Foreign nationals are funding that. Foreign individuals are funding that. Where are they getting their money? Through the balance of trade. Because if you'll remember that we are importing about $60 billion a month more than we are exporting. Now, admittedly, a lot of that is due to the price of oil. But nevertheless, we're running $50 to a $60 billion trade deficit per month. Now, when that money comes into other countries, what are they doing with it? Well, they're turning right around, in addition, I guess, to buying real estate worldwide, they're buying our IOUs. They're buying our U.S. Treasury paper, which of course is the safest paper in the world. But there's a problem. When they buy our U.S. Treasury paper and they are paid an interest rate, eventually they cash it in. Eventually it matures. And if they're getting paid back in cheaper, devalued dollars, they're not so excited about that because they're actually earning a negative rate of return when they are receiving their money back because our value of our dollar has decreased. So the real question is whether these countries, whether these nationals, whether these individuals are willing to continue to buy our paper if our dollar starts into some kind of decline. Or alternatively, are we going to finally have to bite the bullet and cut back on our spending? Which I've never met a politician who is willing to do that. Whether they're Democrats, Republicans, liberals, or conservatives, show me one who is willing to cut back, and I'll be very, very surprised. And I will stand to be corrected if one of those people really, truly exists. So it's a tough question. It's a great question, but I'm not quite as concerned on the dollar side of it as I am concerned on the deficit spending side of it, as well as the balance of payment side. And again, what really happens is that we thrust all of these problems, whether it's trade deficit, whether it's balance of payments, whether it's Social Security, whether it's Medicare, we're really thrusting these problems on the next generation. And that in itself is unconscionable.
Okay. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. And other people who have questions are welcome to call. We're a bit past our midpoint here. This is our monthly show on personal finance. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance at U of I. And as I say, once a month, always on Friday, he's here. We talk about money management, investment topics. And if you have questions, I know he'll do his best to help you out. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
You know, David, one of the real anomalies that is taking place in investing today, and it really has Alan Greenspan even shaking his head, and that is that every time the Federal Reserve has raised what's called the Fed funds rate, now Greenspan and the Federal Reserve have raised that rate 8 times. It used to be a 1% rate. Now the target rate is 3%. That's the overnight rate at which banks borrow from each other. And presumably, if it costs more for banks to borrow from each other, it's going to cost us more to borrow. But what's been happening is that as short-term rates have moved up, you would think that long-term rates would also move up. But that really hasn't happened. Witness the mortgage market, where we have very, very reasonable, inexpensive mortgage rates almost back to their historic lows of 18 months ago. And it's very interesting, again, where we've got short-term interest rates moving up and long-term interest rates really moving down in some senses. So I want to make the point that I don't think it's intelligent at the moment for investors to go out a long way on the maturity curve if they are fixed income investors. You don't want to be out there 8 to 10 years buying maturities that long. Now, if you are in a bond ladder and you're typically in a 5-year bond ladder, then by all means continue your bond ladder, but don't extend your ladder at this point in time because it just doesn't pay in terms of interest rates. The better premiums are actually at the shorter end of the maturity schedule, in the 18-month, 24-month, and even the 30-month area. That's where you're right now getting more bang for your buck.
Okay. We have a caller in Streeter. Let's talk with them. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick question on the concept of if you have your investments in a number of different mutual funds and one seems to do quite well, what's your idea of the concept of drawing off the fund that's making the gains and investing in the fund that's to keep your portfolio balanced across the dollar-wise?
Well, I think that people should rebalance their positions. And typically, I don't believe in rebalancing every month, every 3 months, at most rebalancing every 6. And frankly, a lot of even professionals rebalance once a year. So, for example, is that what you do?
Yes.
Okay. So, for example, if you had an asset class maybe in the real estate investment trust area, the REITs, or the emerging markets area, And if you had those particular asset classes, they probably had very, very substantial returns in 2004. It might have been prudent at the end of 2004, or early 2005, to take a look at those positions and say, you know, as a percentage of my overall portfolio, I'm a little bit out of kilter and I need to rebalance or reposition, sell a few of those shares off and put them back into my original cookbook percentage. That would certainly be appropriate. You don't need to do it every 3, 6, 9 months, but 12 months certainly works.
You may miss out on some good gains in that regard, but you also are always selling at a profit.
Well, yes, you are selling at a profit, but as my grandmother used to say, you never terribly get hurt selling at a profit, and especially if you have those gains inside a tax-deferred investment. Do you have them inside, for example, a Roth IRA or a profit-sharing or IRA?
Yes, the bulk of it is.
Okay, so then you are operating inside a tax-deferred investment. So you've got the best of all possible worlds where you can take those gains and not pay current tax and reallocate them inside your tax-deferred investment.
Correct.
So that's what I would recommend.
Thanks for your comment.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much. We have another caller here, and I want to make sure that we get to that person, but also apparently someone called in and said that they didn't quite get down your your cookbook portfolio, and we're wondering, could you, real quick, go
sure.
over it one more time, how you allocate your...
Be happy to do that.
Your investment there.
Well, again, it's 50% in bond funds and 50% in stock index funds. 25 cents of my bond money is in the Vanguard Short-Term Bond Index. And 25% of my bond money, or 25 cents, is in the Vanguard Total Bond Market Index. So that takes care of 50 cents of my dollar. It's gone. It's spent. And I might not put it all in at one time. I might average into that position over 12 to 18 months. That's a different day and a different story. But again, I'm just kind of giving you the cookbook. 5 cents goes into the S&P 500. 5 cents goes into the mid-cap index. And 5 cents goes into the small-cap index, often referred to as the Russell 2000. 10 cents goes into something called the Vanguard Value Index. That's large value. 10 cents goes into the Vanguard Small Cap Value Index. And now I've got 15 cents left to allocate to stocks. 5 cents into the REIT, REIT Index. 5 cents into the Emerging Markets Stock Index. And 5 cents into the Total International Stock Index. And I think if you add all of that up, that's 50 cents in stocks, 50% in fixed income. And that's what I sort of call my old-fashioned cookbook portfolio.
All right. Let's go on to someone here locally, Champaign-Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Comment on the so-called housing bubble. Like, it used to be prices would very closely track M3 and inflation, and now, says the news, the charts are going way up fast, and used to be you'd have 20% down, and now you can get no down and cash on closing. And Dickens wrote about Bleak House from personal experience in The Big House. Just wondering, are there any penalties on if you sell the house early? Do you still owe the full amount of the mortgage, or just for the amount of time you've had the money? Because it used to be that people would sell a house at a loss during a depression to get out of liabilities and going to the big house.
Ah, well, that's an interesting question. And, you know, that depends on what state that you're living in. In Illinois, we are a mortgage state, which means that if you sell your house, or rather your house is foreclosed, and the lender doesn't recover all of the outstanding principal and interest, there is a deficiency judgment that is levied against you. And if you signed personally on the paperwork, then you are personally liable for the deficiency judgment, and any other asset that you own then is at risk. So you have personal liability and personal responsibility in Illinois. In contradistinction to that, however, in California, naturally everything is different in California. California is what's called a deed of trust state. So all of these folks who go out and buy a new property and then procure a mortgage, and it's really called a deed of trust, if they walk away from their property, they bought a $1 million property, it falls in value to $750,000, and they have a $900,000 mortgage, they just simply walk away. They're not responsible. Okay? The property itself is the security for the promise to repay the mortgage. So there is no deficiency judgment, and there is no personal liability. Hence, about all that you would be out would be your down payment and, of course, whatever interest you had paid on the mortgage. Now, as you mentioned, sometimes you can get 100% loan to value. So people who got 100% loan to value, an interest rate loan only, they paid some interest and suddenly there was a housing bubble crash and the value of the house went down $200,000 or $300,000. Well, these folks in California could simply pack their bags and move and stick the lender. And then the question becomes, well, who is the lender? Guess what? The lender of record, typically, when everything is said and done, is going to be the federal government. So who's going to bail these people out? Guess what? It's going to be the David Inges, the David Sinos, and you of the world who are going to end up somehow taxes are going to bail this whole situation out. Is that fair? No, it's not fair, but that's the way the game is played.
All right. Let's go on again. Liz's next caller is Urbana, line number one.
Hi.
Hello. Yes.
I think the phrase is the end of the oil economy, the idea that production is going to be difficult to increase and over, say, the next 20 years will decline, and that as China and India and other economies come online, demands are going to, for oil are going to increase. And therefore, should an investor for the long run be thinking about that and how that's going to affect lifestyles and employment and a whole lot of other things that will have an impact on their investments? I wonder if David could talk about that. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, there certainly has been a lot of literature written about the fact that it's pretty darn difficult to increase fossil fuel production at the current time, especially in the oils. Part of that is due to refinery capacity as well, where we haven't built any additional refineries, at least in the United States, I think, in approximately 30 years. But the question becomes, obviously, even if we could produce more oil with this dramatic increase in demand from other parts of our world, i.e. China and to a lesser extent India and the Pacific Rim, that what does that mean in terms of an oil economy? Now, if you talk to Exxon, Exxon thinks just the opposite. They think that over the next 30 or 40 years that we're going to continue to increase oil and oil production. At least that's the way it was reported in the Wall Street Journal. I'm sort of the camp also that we are probably going to have a pretty difficult time to increase major oil production, and demand is obviously going to continue to go up. We now have a Chinese community of over almost, what, a billion people, and we have 150 million people of that billion that are pretty middle class, pretty much like the U.S. That's 850 million people who are trying to move in to that middle class, and a government committed to moving more and more people into that middle class, and a government that needs to create dramatic amounts of job opportunities to sort of keep things politically in tow. So they are going to have this voracious demand, as you just pointed out, for oil and fossil fuels to continue to fund their economy. So, yeah, it's a problem. What I think is going to happen, and again, I may be dead wrong about this, I think you are going to see a renaissance in the nuclear power industry. I think that is what is going to happen. And I think we're starting to see the seeds of that already, where, for example, one of our local power vendors, Dynergy, has applied preliminarily for certificates to investigate building more nuclear facilities in central Illinois. And I think we're going to see more and more of this over the next several years. And I think we're going to see a renaissance in that industry. It's going to be a battle. It's going to be a political fight. But I think that's what's going to happen. So that's my conclusion about it. And in terms of investing, it's tough. It's tough to say how that should affect our investing, other than if you read some of the other economic pundits, they suggest that a asset class that we should now be looking at with our investments, perhaps as much as 5 to 10%, are in the oil industry, in the fossil fuel industry, and are now beginning to treat that as a whole new asset class of investing, just like a REIT, just like real estate is an asset class of investing. And I can't disagree with that. So that may be a new element of your portfolio.
Excuse me. Well, again, we have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance. If you have questions, I'm sure we can get one person at least in here in the time that remains. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
Some good news, David, on the manufacturing front. Some good news on the inflation front. We've seen that retail inflation, at least reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, seems to be at about that 3% level. It actually dropped last month. Producer price index still pretty tame. And additionally, we seem to have increased manufacturing production. So all of these things suggest that our economy is stable. It's continuing to expand. And I think that will enable Alan Greenspan at the next meeting of the Federal Reserve to continue to raise these short-term interest rates so that the target Fed funds rate may well go from 3% to actually 4% between now and December.
We now have picked up some other callers. We'll see how many we can get. First in line is Normal. Line one.
Yes. I've listened to your show over a long period of time, and the more I hear, the more I realize that I'm kind of delinquent in my knowledge of all the terminology and strategies that one might pick for their portfolio. And I wondered if there's a book that you would recommend that a person can sit down with and get a total overview of, you know, this versus that.
Yes.
Fees that might be incurred using this plan or that plan. So
I think the Wall Street Journal Guide to Money and Investing is a wonderful little read. It's about 150 pages. It's put out by Lightbulb Press. In fact, there's another one called the Wall Street Journal Guide to Financial Planning, also put out by Lightbulb Press. Again, an easy read. They make sense. They're excellent overviews. They're a wonderful starting place to familiarize yourself with investment terms and financial planning terms. And I think they cost about $12 to $15 each. They're available at your local bookstore.
Thank you.
All right. And Champagne next, line two.
Hi. I have a question related, I guess, to the interest rates, because I'm a grad student and I have recently found a letter in my mailbox saying that I need to consolidate my loans.
You bet.
From undergrad.
You bet.
Beforehand. And so do you think it's a good time to consolidate, and even if I'm going to continue in grad school for a number of years?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You want to consolidate those loans, and you may have actually missed a pretty good window. If you had done this over a month ago, I think you would find that when you consolidate, your rate would be about 1% less than the current consolidation rate. Get on it right away.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
All right. Time to get one more. A listener from Annapolis, Maryland, must be listening on the internet. Hello.
Yes. What portfolio would you recommend for somebody that's, say, 70 years old?
This portfolio.
This one?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest mistake people make is that they think they're going to have to get very, very conservative and go to all fixed income on their life. At 70 years of age, your actuarial life expectancy is probably around 88 to 90. So that's the good news. And don't make the mistake of putting all of your money into fixed income, because you lose your inflation hedge, and then people do run out of money before they run out of life. So at 60, 70, 80, this is a great portfolio.
I understood all of these are Vanguard index funds?
Yes, they are.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right, My pleasure.
And that's just, you're not particularly
wedded to Vanguard. No. There's lots of index funds from lots and lots of providers. It's just an easy place to go to an internet. Fidelity is another example. And more of these major mutual funds are offering indexes because they realize that more people are interested in something like passive management.
Yeah. And the advantage of using a large family of funds like that is that they do have these. You can basically under one umbrella, you can do this, as you suggested, you put it all in these different kinds
of
funds.
Sure, no question about it.
Given that some people do have this concern about the economy of the United States, I wonder if that would argue some people might say, you know, you're only putting 10% of your money in international stocks, whether that would argue possibly for increasing that piece of your...
David, that's a good point, and it would if you're willing to take on a little bit more risk and move perhaps to a 60-40 portfolio where 60% is equities and 40% is fixed income, then I would take that remaining 10% and I would move that more into the international sector.
Yeah. Well, I guess at that, we will finish up for this time around. My apologies. It looks like we got some more people trying to call in, but for this time around, we'll have to say thanks to our guest, David Senno. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I. He's with us here once a month, always on a Friday, to do this program, and we'll see you in July then.
Thanks, David. It's always a pleasure, and thanks to our wonderful audience.
All right. The broadcast today is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925, Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Focus 580 is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking with journalist Christina Rathbone. She spent close to 5 years visiting some of the prisoners in America's oldest prison for women, MCI Framingham. Women are the fastest growing group of inmates in the nation. And one of the things that she wanted to explore was the basic question, what happens to them in prison? The author is Christina Rathbone. That is author of a book titled A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Beyond Bars, and she'll be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news, weather, sports, other things. Coming up in the next part of this show, we'll be talking with Bakari Kitwana, probably one of this country's leading experts on hip-hop culture, and he has a new book out that's titled Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop. We'll talk about that in the next part of the show. We'll take a break here first for news from NPR and an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL.